phone, and I talked to his machine. He called back and talked to my machine. And when we finally did get together, he told me that his wife was real concerned about this chairperson. Because when I had said on air, I wanted to speak to him because I didn't want to get up here dry. And she just thought that was a really bad sign. Fred knew what I was talking about. I wanted to be able to tell some jokes about him. But being a good alcoholic like he is and I am, he forgot to tell me any and I forgot to remember any. But I do know that from speaking with him that he has a lot to say. And I want to introduce Fred R.
My name is Fred, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow. Well, I've been real scared for about 11 months since Dick called me up and asked me to do this. This is the first time I ever spoke at a convention. And I'll tell you that because I'm going to go for the pity right away. Get your sympathy and get you on my side and feeling sorry for me. And I've been telling everybody since I got here about how scared I was and how upset I was because they told me in AA that you should talk about how you feel. And when I was drinking, when I was growing up, I didn't tell anybody anything. I just kept my mouth shut. And so I've been sharing that with a lot of people. And I came up here on a stage just now, sat down, and I did something that I learned to do in AA. And that was I asked my higher power for help because I'm scared. And a feeling of calm just came over me. That's makes me even more scared. Every time that damn thing works, it just amazes me, you know. And I've been doing that for a lot of years, but it just amazes me. So poor Charles up here is more nervous than I am right now. And the reason we didn't flip that coin before was that neither one of us could flip a coin at that point in time. And I got to thank some people first and tell you just real briefly how privileged I am to be here. Dick is the guy that called me up, and I thought he was calling me to sell me copy paper. So I almost hung up on him when he called because I was working and I was rushed, and I thought it was just another salesman calling me. And that's another indication of how my program works. I usually shortcut a lot of things and probably have missed a lot of things because I didn't give him enough time. And I thank God I gave Dick enough time, and he told me what he was really calling for. And I'm here. And I just met Mary, the lady that heard my tape that I didn't know that you all had. That's another higher power story. Johnny, who met me at the airport, and Charles here, and all you folks for this hospitality that you've given me. And I just want to tell you, I'm real sorry about filling up that cooler last night with all that food. So I won't do it again. Take my jacket off so you can see where that food went. By the way, the last time I was in front of this many people, I was in court. So I hope that this works out better than that did. What else? People give you a lot of advice when you're doing this, you know? Like Charles just told me some of his mother's advice that she gave him. And he shared that with me. I want to thank you, Charles, for that. Would you like to hear some of that? It was if you're going on a long trip, be sure and change your underwear. And if you're getting up to speak, go to the men's room first. So I did. My wife gave me some advice. She said, go up there and talk from your heart and just let people know who you are and God talks through you. And then she said, don't talk like a Southerner. Seems like any time I'm in Texas or any place, I pick this thing up, you know. And I'm from New Jersey, man, you know. So, yeah, I'm going to give you a little New Jersey, you know what I mean? Every once in a while, I'm going to have to compensate a little bit. So I am from New Jersey. So, and I got a lot of other advice, but I'm here to tell you a story, my story. I was talking to a gentleman over here before about getting up here, and he said, just get up there, you know, tell a couple of jokes. So I told him I'd just tell my life. You know, that's been a joke. So we'll get started with my life. My growing up as a young man, as a child, had a lot to do with what I learned about being a man, and how I tried to live this life. So I'd like to start talking about my life in Paterson, New Jersey, if you know where that is. And right now I live in Lake Hopatcong. I should tell you that. Some of you people probably think that all of New Jersey is blacktop, and that's not true, you know. I live in Lake Hopatcong, as Charlie helped me. Charlie speaks Indian. I don't know if you know that. But he helped me last night, and he told me. I've lived in Lake Hopatcong for 10 years. He finally told me what it means in Indian. And what it means is land of many drunks. So I want to thank you, Charlie, for that interpretation. Help me out there. Fortunately, the whole time I've been there, I've been sober, so... But the man's right. Anyway, I grew up in Paterson, New Jersey, and Paterson's about 20 minutes outside of New York City. And it's the city, as far as I'm concerned. It's a tough place. And when I grew up there in the 1950s and 1940s and 1950s, especially in the 1950s, you had to belong to a gang, you know, to survive in Paterson. Street gangs, you know, there's nothing new going on in California. It happened out in Paterson first. But we belong to a street gang, and all my life I've always been a guy that if I'm going to do something, I got to do it. You know, I mean, I'm just not going to sit in the car and watch it go by. I'm going to do it. And if I'm going to join a gang, I'm going to join a gang. You know, and there are a lot of these little fairy gangs around, but I had to join the toughest gang in Paterson, and I was looking for that gang. And the toughest gang in Paterson was called the Warlords. And Warlords were the toughest gang in Paterson, you know, because they had the most guys in the county jail. And we even had a couple of guys that were in state prison for murder. I said, whoa, this is the gang, you know. So to join the Paterson gang, you had to do things. You had to do deeds of valor, you know. You had to steal honesty boxes, they used to call them, with the newspapers in them. And you take a sledgehammer and you hit the box with a sledgehammer, all the money popped out, you know. And he bring that back to the chief, you know, as a deed of valor, you know. And then he had to cut somebody, and he had to do all these things. And he finally got to have a jacket, and he got to be a warlord. And he put that jacket on, and you stand on a corner in Paterson. And with that jacket on, you know, you were like there, you know. You had that collar up, and you had an attitude, you know. Nobody ever stood still. Everybody's always moving. Take your comb out every once in a while and do your hair, put the comb back, had a piece of chain hanging out of your pocket, maybe a switchblade, you know, engineer boots. There was a song that was out, and that was our uniform of the day. Black denim trousers with a buckle on the back, engineer boots, black leather jacket, collar up, warlords across the back, you know, and you were tough. And you could walk any place in New Jersey, in Paterson, and nobody bothered you because you were in a warlord's. That was about the best thing could have ever happened to me. Except for one thing. I was scared to death. I was scared, man. My father died in a bar fight when I was 4. So there was nobody home to back me up. There was nobody home to come and get me out of trouble. Except I had an uncle. And my uncle was a captain in the police department. And every time I'd get in trouble, he'd come down and he'd say, now, and that big old Irish guy, you know, and he'd say, well, now, Freddy, you're not going to do this again to your poor mother, are you? And I'd say, no, Uncle John, you know, and he walked me out of the police department. But out in the street, you know, there was nobody there. So I was there by myself. Now, we'd hang out in this corner in Paterson, and on this corner in Paterson, there was a place in front behind us called the Dublin Rams AC. Now, that stands for Athletic Club. But I got to tell you, there was nothing athletic going on in this club. It was the bookie joint. That's where the pool tables were. That's where the deals were going down. We were outside. We were the big Irish guys, and we were outside, and we were there to, you know, kind of protect the establishment, which is what we thought. They had about 43 guys inside with guns, but, you know, we thought we were outside to protect it. And on another corner, it was a big corner here, four corners. Another corner, there was a place called La Grocería Hispania. All right, a Spanish grocery, Puerto Rican guys would hang out in front of that place. Now, another corner, on the other side of the street, was a Big Ike's Tavern. And Big Ike's Tavern over there, that was all blacks-only tavern. And a bunch of black guys would hang out over there. And we'd have our gangs there on the corners, you know. And, you know, we'd exchange comments on current events and politics and some of the girls walking by and that. And, you know, every gang's got a little guy. You know, every gang's got a little guy with a big mouth. You know, we had ours. And this little guy with the big mouth was out there. He'd be out there in my corner, this little Irish guy, and I tell you his name. But he'd be out there in a corner, and he'd be yelling at these other groups of guys, saying, "Hey, come on over here and say that." You know, and trying to be as bad and as mean as he could be. You know, my job in the warlords was really just kind of to be big, you know. So I'd stand there and try to look as big as I could, you know. And inside, when this guy would get out there and start yelling, inside, I'd be saying, "Oh, God, please don't let them come over here. These guys carry knives, and they got guns and zip guns, and, you know, please." And, you know, this would be Saturday night, and Sunday morning I'd have to get up and serve Mass, and I'd say, "Oh, God, please. My mother's going to kill me." Now, I'm not worried about these Puerto Rican guys or these black guys. I'm just worried about going home to my mother with a couple of stitches, because she's going to kill me, you know. But, you know, something would happen out there on that corner. Something would happen. 14, 15 guys standing there. We get a quart of beer. They pass that quart of beer around. Take a little pull on that quart of beer. Whew. And another quart of beer would go by. Take a little pull on that. Oh, maybe a pint of Muscatel will go around. Oh, next thing I know, I'm out there saying, "Hey, come on over here and say that." See, when you're 14 years old and you're standing on a corner in Patterson and you're scared to death and you put something inside of here, it takes it all away. You remember that. And the next time you get that feeling, you do it again. And it takes it away again. And the next time you get that feeling, you do it again. And then you do it because you might get the feeling. And then you get it because the last time you had it, it worked, and you think that that might happen in a couple of days, so you better be prepared. Why wait till the last minute? And before you know it, you're doing it all the time. And that's what I did. And it works. It works. That's the problem. It works. Okay? I did that until it stopped working. In fact, I did it past the point where it stopped working. Keep trying to get it back. And I couldn't. But my main goal in Patterson was to get out of Patterson. You know, it was a good goal. I thought it was well advised at the time. And the only way I had to get out of Patterson, because my father got killed. My mother scrubbed floors. We had no money. So the only way I had to get out of Patterson was play ball. And that was my ticket out. That's the way I figured it. My brother-in-law, who was like the male influence in my life, my brother-in-law said to me, he was all-state football, and he said, "You know, you got everything that I was lacking. You know, you can do this." And I said, yeah, you know, he's right, you know. He got that attitude, you know. So I said, "Yeah, I can do this." So he said, "All you got to do is start lifting weights. You build up, you get strong. People are going to come and see you. I was fast for a big guy. I was fast. And you can do this, you know." So I did. I started lifting weights and building up, and I was good. I was good, see? But I wasn't that good. All right? Now, what happened was the little school came around in junior year, and they give these letters of intent and whatever they call these things. You know, they wanted to sign me up. And I didn't want to commit to this school because it wasn't big time enough. You know, I want to hold out for Notre Dame, you know? So I had that attitude. Like, you know, I'm big, man, you know. And Notre Dame never showed up. In fact, I'm still waiting for Notre Dame. So I don't think it's going to happen. But I had this problem in those years, and that was I had about 8 people living in my head. I had this warlords gang member. I had this athlete. I had a scholar. You know, I was a pretty smart kid in school. I was on a debating society. You know. And in the same head, this guy that would stand out in the corner and yell at these guys, you know, he lived in the same head. I had a guy in here that wanted to be a priest. You know, I don't know where the hell he came from. What? What'd you say you want to be a priest? You know, push him back in there, get back there. I had to make a decision. I had about 8 people I had to get together. I said, well, what are we going to do, guys? You know, and any given day, you never know who's coming out, you know. Sometimes they came out like, and you didn't expect that guy out, and you know, you needed the altar boy there, and all. And then a warlord's guy was there, and so, oh my God, you know. So it was hard to get past that point where I had like just maybe 2 or 3 people in control, you know. And I did, and I got to that point where I just had this one guy in there that was the driver. He was the guy, man, he was the pusher, you know. This was the guy that just said, just tell me what it is, man. You know, just tell me what that next thing is to do. And that guy began to surface, and that was the guy I liked because this was an achiever, you know. This was a guy that did things. You know, I developed that attitude of just give me the ball, man. Tell me where you want it. You know, just give me the ball. And I liked that guy because he did things, you know. He got cars and he got the girls and he got the honors. He got to list his name on the honor roll. And, you know, that was a guy, you know. That was a guy. And I thought, that's me, you know, that's me. See, that guy could do anything he wanted to anybody. And he'd just take a little something to drink and it goes away. You know, so kind of way to soothe your conscience, you know. And I liked that guy. Well, what happened was I went to college, you know, because people said, well, got to go to college. And I went to college, and in college, it was tough because, you know, nobody was paying the bills. I was paying the bills, you know, because, see, Notre Dame never came around. So I was paying the bills, and I was working jobs, and if I had a time open, I had a job for that time. You know, I worked Saturdays and Sundays in a gas station, and I worked evenings, you know, doing something else. And I was a beef lugger. I worked for Armor Meat, you know, and I loved beef. And boy, that made me tough for football, and I loved that, you know. And I went to school days, and I went to school nights, and I went to school Saturdays and intercessions. And you tell me, I did it, man, any way I could, you know. And finally, the last 2 years I was going to school, I was a Teamster, and I'm driving a truck, you know, and I'm going to school. Did you know that Teamsters drink? Did you know that? Anywhere I went, man, I found them, you know. I found guys drinking cold beers in freezers in a meat locker, you know. I mean, they're so have one of these, man. It'll warm me up. It don't make any sense, but, you know, have that, man, you know. And guys used to like to see me. The butchers used to like to see me come into the butcher shops because they were a big guy, you know. And they say, every butcher I ever went to had a bad back. You know, they say, listen, kid, can you move some of those rounds for me and meet the side in there? And I got a quarter hanging there. And yes, sir, you know. And I go in the meat locker and just drink all the booze they found in there. Well, you know. So I had a good job there, you know. But finally I got out of school, you know. And here I am now. I'm a teacher. School teacher, hey, and professional, hey, and my first job teaching school was $5,100 a year. That was back in 1966, something like that, and I was real proud of this. See, I went to school 6 years to get out of college, you know, not because I was dumb, just because I was poor, you know, 6 years to get out of school, and I'm leaving a Teamster job now, and I'm pulling my truck in that last night on a job. And the shop steward says to me, he says, Fred, I've always wanted to ask you, he said, why are you quitting this job to go teach school? He said, you know you're going to be making half as much money as you're making right now. Why would you do that? And I said, I don't know. See, everybody always told me, just go to school. You know, nobody told me, figure out how much money you're making. And now here I am a professional and I got this degree and I'm going to be making half as much money as I was before. And I don't know why I'm doing that. So I went to school and I started teaching and I was there about 4 months and I figured out that I hate these kids. So, but see, I went to school for 6 years to do this, right? So I got to teach school, you know, so because I'm one of those guys, man, just give me the ball, you know. Say, degree, yeah, okay, man, you know. And here I am, you know. Now, I hated these kids, and you know, I figured, well, you know, got to get out of the classroom. How do I do this? So I'm sitting in the teacher's room one day, and this guy comes in the teacher's room, and where he's an older man, and he's been around the school system for a while, so we came in the teacher's room, and he's sitting there, and talking, and he said, sounds to me like you're looking to make some more money. I said, yeah. He said, well, what you got to do? He says, you got to make money in school teaching. He says, you got to be an administration. I said, well, what do you got to do to be in administration? He says, well, you have to go to school. I said, well, what are you talking about? He said, well, you got to get a master's degree, you know, take you maybe 3 or 4 years, then you got to get in line, you know, because there's older men ahead of you, you know, And you get in line, and maybe 4 or 5 years after you get that degree, you know, you get to be a principal. It's okay. Give me the ball, man. So here we go now, you know. 3 years later, I was assistant principal. Nothing to this deal. This is easy. Just tell me what you want. See, just tell me where it is. See, now, you know, 3 years later, I had the degree. I had the job. I just compressed that whole 9 years or so into 3 years, and I was making twice as much money as I was making as a teacher. See, now, it never occurred to me that I could have went back to the Teamsters job and made twice as much money, and I wouldn't have had to go to school for the last 3 years, you know, but that's not the way we are. Just tell me where you go, man, straight ahead, you know, and that's the way I did it. So now I'm teaching school. Now I'm assistant principal, you know, and you know what assistant principals do? They're in charge of discipline, right? So now every day I got about 30 of the worst kids in the building in my office. All right? I hated the good ones. All right? Now I got 30 of these tough guys, you know, and they say, yeah, I cut costs, you know, I think I would kill them. Kill them. It's the only way out. We'll kill them all. We'll start over, you know. Smelling the good teacher over there. That's it, you know, I'll just kill him. And superintendent frowned on that, so make him hard to get his next board, you know, his budget passed. So I found that if I went out and had a couple of beers at lunchtime, you know, they weren't so bad in the afternoon. Of course, if you went out after work and had a few more, then you didn't even think about the day. Of course, when you woke up the next morning, you had to think about going back in, you know, but that's the way it was. And that got me through a few years of that. And I was making some money now, teaching school. So I'm out there looking for a house. So making all this money, figure, well, let's go find a house, honey. So we were out trying to buy this house. And I'm in a real estate office, and I see this guy that I used to teach school with. I said, well, hey, Barry, how you doing? Say, how are you? I said, what are you doing here, man? Oh, man, I'm making money now. I said, well, how are you making this money? He said, selling real estate. I said, well, how you get to be a real estate salesman? I said, you got to go to school, man. School? I'd do school. What are you talking about, school? Well, it'll take you about 4 months, 16 weeks. You take the real estate test, and you're a salesman. Nothing to this, man. 16 weeks later, I was a real estate salesman. Got rid of the kids. Making money. See, now when you go out to lunch as a real estate salesman, you don't have to go back and talk to the kids. So you don't have those little kids saying, is that beer on your breath? You know? They're gone, man. They're gone, see? So I'm out there selling real estate. I'm making some money. And things are going great. I'm loving this, you know? Except, I sit in that office in the morning. And I'm in there at 8 o'clock trying to make these deals, you know? And I'm driving this new Chevy. Every morning, this broker comes in. He's driving his Cadillac. I'm watching him. I figure I'm making this guy all that money that he can drive that Cadillac. So one day I went in his office. I said, hey, Harold, how do you get to make the real money, the real estate? And he said, you got to be a broker. So, well, how you get to be this broker, man? Got to go to school. I said, oh, yeah. Okay. What is this? Take you about 2 months. 2 months? Piece of cake, man. I already had the 2 years in, had all the kinds of deals I had to make. 2 months, go to school. I'm a broker. Nothing to it. Great. Loved it. Fabulous. Just tell me where you want it, man. Give me the ball, you know? Except for one thing. This was 1973. Now, if you know what was going on in real estate business in 1973, we had a thing called a mortgage crunch. Crunch me right out of business. There I am now, 1973. But let me tell you how things worked. Some incredible things happened to me in that real estate office. And I think this was all part of my higher powers plan to get me moved around, to get me to a point where I could be helped, you know, because of this attitude. What happened to me in that real estate office, what happened to me up there was that my wife, now wife, came to work for me. when I was in that real estate office. And I think that was part of God's design, you know, for this whole thing. I was in that real estate office, and I went in business with this guy because we drank together, and that's how I knew I could trust him. We were sitting in a bar one day. We were working for this other guy, stealing him blind. So we figured, well, listen, we're making all the money for this fool. Why don't we go out and do this on our own? So Dennis was a builder, and he had been a school teacher, and he was an industrial arts teacher, and he was building the houses. I was selling them, and I was so good, I was selling them from blueprints. People didn't even say, this is your piece of land. This is the house we're putting on here. Sign this. You know, and it was that's about how all it took, you know. And we were good. So we're sitting in a bar one day, and we decided that we ought to do this on our own. So we did. And it worked well. It worked well for us for quite a period of time. You know, in fact, we spent a lot of time in that bar. In fact, we met in that bar just about every morning. And when things started to turn bad for us, what we did was we just stayed in the bar. You know, the hell, you know, you're going to go out of here, people are going to be chasing us and calling us up, and you got guys with backhoes and tractor trailers trying to chase you down and trying to get you to my dent my Cadillac, you know. So I just figured we'd stay in the bar. We're sitting in a bar one day, and it was one of those rainy days, and you're just sitting there and trying to figure out what we should do for the day, and we figured that there was just so many problems out there that we probably just ought to just stay right in that bar. So we're sitting there, and Dennis and I are just, you know, having a beer, you know, like you do, 9:30 in the morning, and sitting there having a beer, and about 10 o'clock, this guy comes in. This guy owned a travel agency next door to this bar. He comes in. And 10 o'clock in the morning, imagine this. Man runs in there, has two shots. Boom, boom. And he leaves. I thought, that's rather curious. About 11:30, he comes back in the bar. Has two shots. Boom, boom. And he left again. About 12:30, came in, had two shots, a beer, and left. About 2:30, he came back in, had three shots. Boom, boom, boom. And he left. About 4:45, he came in, he had three shots again. And he left. About 6 o'clock now, he came in. I said to Dennis, watch this guy. He's got a problem. Man's been in and out of here all day. Kind of tells you where I'm at, right? We hadn't left all week. The guy went and took care of some business, you know. Well, that's where we were. That's right where we were. We're in that real estate office. And see, when you work for yourself and you call in sick, nobody's there, you know. So we were out all the time having this good time trying to kill myself with all the money we were making. And Dennis and I ended up splitting our ways, you know, but some good things happened in between. And what really happened was this lady came to work for me in this real estate office. And probably the worst thing that ever happened to me was making some money. And I don't have it anymore, so I can talk about it. That was probably the worst thing. And to make it even worse, what happened was I made a lot of money real fast. So it was like it wasn't real money, you know. It was like play money, like Monopoly, you know. It was like a game, you know. So it wasn't really life. So in this real estate office, we had a problem. See, Dennis was a charmer, and you know how charming I am. So Dennis and I, we were always taking the girls that work for us out. So nobody was in the office. See? So that's a problem when you're trying to make money, you know. So one of the girls left. Her husband was complaining, so she left, and that was our secretary. And that's the way we are. So what happened was I put an ad in the paper, and nobody responded to it because I guess nobody's husband would let him come work for us. So we found through the grapevine in the town that we lived in, we found this lady who called me up and said that she wanted to work for us. And we were a young, aggressive firm, said all the right things. I said, yeah, that's me, yeah. So she came in for the interview. Now, I have no idea how to interview somebody. I mean, I just, you know, I looked at her. I said, nice legs. You're hired. And then she told me that she was sober. And I said, man, am I good or what? You know, look at this. I hired a sober person to work in the office. Now somebody's going to be here. is that good or what, you know? And she's sitting right here, see? So if you're good secretary and you get your boss sobered up, he'll probably marry you sometime. Especially if you're sober 5 years longer than he is. She can get me to do anything. You might think that's a good thing, by the way, that your wife's sober 5 years longer than you. You might think that's a good thing, unless, of course, you're married to an Al-Anon. But you might think that's a good thing. And it is. It has its assets, you know. Every once in a while, you come home and you got a new four-step done for you. Sit right there. Oh, I didn't know that was wrong with me. Look at that. Look at that. Then she gets mad if you get mad, you know. Yes. Well, the good part about that is that she's a benchmark of my growth. That she's ahead of me, you know, and you can't take that back. 5 years is 5 years. And I got to tell you that there was a time when she gave me a book written by a guy named Demet Fox. And she said, I think you ought to read this. So I took it home and I opened it up and I read that first page in that book. And I thought, oh man, this guy must have died in an insane asylum or something. You know, this makes no sense at all, you know. And I put the book on a shelf, and in case she wanted it back, I know right where it was. And I got to tell you that I try to live by that book today, among other books. Right? Try to live by that book. Now, see, old Emmett, he died, you know. He died in 1933. She gave me that book around 1974. So nothing's changed in that book. Same stuff in that book that was there when she gave it to me, except I changed. So now I understand what's in the book. And we got some other books like that, you know. First time I picked them up, I said, hell, man, these people are crazy, you know. And there's the book, you know. So I'm real happy to speak here today about, you know, especially the theme of this convention being back to basics, because that's what it is. That's what it is. People get away from basics, get drunk. And I did that. See, now that's the voice of experience talking. Because back home, we give out 90-day pins. So every time you get 90 days, you get a pin. And I got a lot of those pins, you know. If they gave out 60-day pins, I'd have some of them. If they gave out 30-day pins, I'd have some of them. If they gave out 26-hour pins, I'd have some of them. In fact, I had 51 weeks sober one time. And I was standing at a bar in Toledo, Ohio. And I didn't go to AA. See, I didn't need to do this. Because, see, with men, if you're really a man, you can do this. See? So I was really a man, see? Because, you know, men drink, you know, men that are really men, they drink a lot. So I was really a man. So all I had to do was just put my mind to this. Just give me the ball, man. Tell me where you want it, and I can get sober. 51 weeks from my last drink, I was standing at a bar in Toledo, Ohio, talking to this young lady standing next to me, and I couldn't think of something to say. So a little thought came to me and said, if you have beer, you know what to say. So I had the beer. I had second beer. And I don't know whatever happened to that young lady standing next to me in that bar. But as soon as I had that beer, priorities changed, you know. Priorities changed. So this lady came to work for me in this real estate office. And I believe God put her in there. A higher power put her in there. Because it's time. It was time. Time for me to get sober. Time for me to start thinking about it. You know, I believe my higher power is up there and he's got all these controls going, you know. And he's like, all right, bring in the lady to the office, you know. And all this stuff going, yeah, yeah, yeah. Get the airplane over here now. Ah, all right, make the phone ring, you know. Okay? And he's so good. He's better than I ever was. He's better than I ever was at my best, my height of manipulation. That's how good he is. And he put this lady in my office, you know. And I'm in there and I'm dying. I'm trying to kill myself drinking. You know, I'm working at this every day. And she's in my office. And I come in that office in the morning and she's there. And the office got so nice when she was there. Everybody was so nice to each other. And I'm in that office and she comes in the morning and she says, hello. How do you do that? And before you know it, I'm saying, hello. So she'd come in my office and she'd say, is the coffee perking too loud? And I thought, you know, she's right. The coffee is perking too loud. What a wonderful woman, you know? She'd do little things to me. See, I'm out there trying to kill myself, so I wasn't in the office. Oh, I got to get out there and do these deals, man. You know, the business you get in the bars is incredible. Well, I got to tell you, now that I sobered up, I never made a deal in a bar. Ever. But when I was drinking, that's what I told her. I got to be out there, man. That's what's happening. People are in there, you know. People are in there getting drunk like me. That's what they're doing. So I never went to the office, but I'd go in the day of the closing, I'd go in. I'd go in the office, get this file that represented the whole deal, you know, the whole transaction. Now, I don't know these people. I never met these people that are involved in this transaction. One of my salesmen did it, see? So I have no idea who they are. But I'm there to get the file, and I go to the closing, and I get to hand over the bill to the lawyer, and the lawyer gives me a check. This is my time. This is my moment, you know. I get to pick up the check and bring it back to the office. All right, big time, great feeling, you know, great feeling, okay? So I show up at this office one day to the lawyer, and I don't know these people. I see four people sitting in there. I don't know who they are. They're buying a house from my office. I have no idea who they are. I do know that Bruninger is the seller. So I got to sit there real quiet, not let them know who I am until I find out who they are. So a lawyer comes out and he says, "Good morning, Mr. Bruninger." And he shakes the guy's hand. I say, "Oh, Mr. Bruninger, he's a seller. Hi, Mr. Bruninger," you know. And that's how I work. So now I'm in the office there and I got the file and I know who everybody is. I'm waiting for my moment, you know, to give the bill over and get the check so I can get out of there and get a drink. So moment comes, I open up the file. And this little red pamphlet in this file says, "Is AA for you?" So, well, close that file up, man. I put it under my arm. I said, "Gee, I had this great secretary. I don't know what's wrong with her, but today she seems to have forgotten to put a bill in the file." And I've kept that file. I realized that a couple of years later. I kept that file right under my arm all the way home, drove home with that. I don't want nobody to know what's in this file, you know. Well, that's the kind of things that she did, see. She invited me to an anniversary. So at this Pyramid Club that we now belong to, and she invited me to her anniversary. And I thought, what a wonderful thing, you know. She's inviting a big timer like me, you know, to this Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Gonna go over there and class up the place, and you know. So I'll do that for her, you know. So she was on my list, you know. So I'll do that for her. So I went out to normal lunch and had a half a dozen or so martinis and a couple of bottles of Heineken's and, you know, just got to take pressure off, you know. Put that hour and 15 minutes in the office and the pressure's incredible. So I went out to have my lunch and went back, checked in, and threw most of the phone calls away that I wasn't going to call back, and made a stack of people that I might call back tomorrow if I felt better. And went back out and had a few more drinks till it was 9 o'clock in time for the meeting. I went over to this meeting. And Pat was up there celebrating, and I walk in this place, and in Newton, and in those days, they had a mahogany bar in this place. It used to be a Elks Club or an Eagles Club or something, and when AA took it over, the AA Club took it over, or the Al-Anon Club took it over, they left the bar there. And I walked in, I see this big red mahogany bar. I said, "Man, I'm going to like this, you know. These people know how to do this." So, but all you could get to drink at that bar was coffee. Okay. So I'm looking there, and it's got my something I missed here today was a rail here, you know. I keep reaching for it, but it's not there, you know. That's how you know you got an alcoholic, you know. Stand him up against the wall and give him something to drink, see that foot come out looking for the rail. Alcoholic, man. Take him to detox, you know. That's it. That's how you do it. I better watch out. Hazel will write that one down, too, you know. Foolproof plan to diagnose alcoholism, done by Fred R. here. Anyway, I'm up there at this bar, and I'm reaching for the rail, you know, and I'm looking down, and they had a rail, too, you know. I'm looking down this bar, and I'm looking at all these people on this bar, you know. These are faces that I've seen any place I've been around the country. I saw these faces, you know, the same people, except for one thing. They weren't drinking. And nobody was trying to solve, you know, the gas crisis. You know how in a bar everybody's got a solution. Well, let me tell you what they ought to do, you know. Nobody's doing this. You're trying to get the boys out of Vietnam. Nobody's talking about that either. These people are talking about things that I don't even know anything about. Peace of mind. You know. That's for the guys that work in the coal mine, man. You're big time. You don't get peace of mind, you know. They're talking, they're laughing, they're enjoying themselves. You know, now, that didn't sober me up, but it stayed in my head. So there's something attractive about that. How did they do that? See, my happiness was going to be in the next. Was always going to be in the next, you know. I was a poor kid from Patterson, and I got into the construction business, real estate business, and we made a lot of money. And we rebuilt houses, and we sold them. That's what we did, my wife and I, my first wife and I. So we worked ourselves down, and this lake I lived in had it was made an old valley. The farther, higher up you lived, the poorer you were, you know. So if you got down right on the lake, you were rich. Now, even if you thought you got to be rich, they had a little island in the middle of the lake with a couple of houses on it. That's where the really rich people wanted to live. So I worked my way down, rebuilt a house, sold it, 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 and kept working down closer to the lake. I finally got on one of the streets that was lakefront, but not on the lake. And I knew that if somehow I could rebuild this house that I had and sell it and get on a lake, I'd be happy. And I was driving this 1973 Cadillac, brand new white Cadillac with a blue interior. And a leather, and oh man, I was like, you know, but see, I want a Jaguar. So I knew if I could get that 74 Jaguar and park it in a driveway of that lakefront house, I'd be happy. Most of these people in Newton were walking. They were happy. That stuck in my head. How did they do that? How did they do that? Didn't sober me up, but it stuck in my head. I stayed in there for a while. You know, I tried AA, it was in and out. I tried just about every combination. If there's anybody new, you want to know what doesn't work, I can tell you that. I tried most of the combinations, you know. I figured if I wasn't drinking, I don't have to go to meetings, right? Because what's the purpose of meetings? To get you to stop drinking. I already stopped. I don't have to go. Finally, some old guy in a meeting said to me, listen, you got to do both these things at the same time. Don't drink and go to meetings. Oh, I got you. The same time. How do you do that? How did I do that? Well, I worked myself to a situation with the house and the business, the real estate and the car and all of that, and I started drinking again, and it's gone. You know, I knew the sheriff's deputy by first name. He was there every day giving me garnishments and judgments, and I had people want to kill me, you know, to keep the party going. Keep the party going. So I take money that didn't belong to me. You know, real estate brokers have things called a trust account. Trust account. Don't trust me with your account. I took it. That's a couple come in, nice young couple. She was deaf and dumb and he was blind. They gave me $4,000 for down payment on a house and I took it. Stole it. Put it in my pocket. Kept the party going. That's one of the reasons I'm not in the real estate business anymore. That's crime. Can't do that. So, but I did. Kept the party going, kept the image up, got to play golf every day, make payment on the Cadillac so they didn't take it away. You got to keep the party going. You got to look good to act good, and you got to act good to make money, be big time. And whatever it takes, that's what you got to do. And that's the way it is. All right? Still, state of New Jersey doesn't agree with that. So, I'm not in real estate business anymore. But that's what I did. About that time when things were all falling apart on me, what happened was I got a job. And I got this job working for a company. And this company sent me to Dallas, Texas. And in Dallas, Texas, I was at the builders convention because I'd done a good job for these people. So they sent me as one of eight guys down to Dallas to represent the company and sell houses. So I'm down there at Dallas. And see, at that point in my life, I either worked or I drank. There was no combination of the two. So I had to work, so I better not drink. So I didn't drink. And I had this guy down there with me named Alan. He's from Pennsylvania. He was my trainer. He was the guy that trained me in this thing. And Alan was everything that I always wanted to be. You know, he was a decorated war hero, Vietnam veteran, highly educated man, number one salesman in the company. Number one salesman. So I really looked up to this guy. And Alan only knew that worker. He only knew the guy with the ball, you know. This guy's straight ahead, man. This guy's good, you know. So we hooked up and we made a lot of deals together. We were selling these great big prefabricated units. So I'm down here in Dallas, and I'm at the convention, and I made my deal. Made my deal. Now, it took to Friday to do that. So it took to Friday, so I couldn't drink. And I'm dying. because all you got to do is sign your name here, man.
You know, so I'm dying. I mean, I'll get out there and start signing some of these checks. So I'm there, and I made my deal. And it was about 11:30 Friday morning, and I went directly to the bar. Directly to the bar, and who's standing next to me but Alan? And I'm having that first scotch, you know. And I took that first scotch, and I take a little sip on that, and wow, that feeling comes back, you know. Take that second pull on that thing. Whoa! By the time I finish that first scotch and I'm halfway through that one and a half scotches, you know, I got that attitude, that personality change starts to come back. And I'm big. And I'm talking to Alan. They stand next to me and I said to Alan, you know, we're at the Fairmont Hotel in Dallas, Texas, by the way. Okay? If any of you ever been there, you know what it's like. I turned to Alan and I said, what do you think they'd take for this place? You know that big-time attitude you get, you know? And Alan said about $80 million, probably. And I said, well, I probably need a partner, you know. Probably somebody with $80 million, you know? But what happened in that room that day was Alan turned to me, and he looked at me in such a way that I never want to see another man look at me like that the rest of my life. I believe Alan looked in my soul that day, and he saw the nothing that was there, the front, the image. He saw the jello that was there. And I stopped drinking that day. That was January 21st, 1976, and I've not found it necessary to take a drink or a drug since that day. That's a miracle. Thank you. Thank you. I should applaud you because I did not do this. If Fred was doing his normal thing, he'd be drunk right now. You know, if Fred gets away from the program, he gets drunk. I proved that. If Fred was taking care of other issues, he'd be drunk. You know, a lot of other issues we hear about today. See, and I just go to AA. That's all I do. Yeah, if I was taking care of some of those other issues, like some of these things we hear about, you know, the inner child, I got a real fear, see. I got a fear about taking care of that inner child. The fear is what's going to happen to the adult without. He's going to be drunk on his ass, man, when I'm taking care of that inner child, you know. So, I got to worry about that. First things first, man. Let me tell you, in early sobriety, when I was getting sober, there were things that I thought were major, major problems. And I was not going to be able to move forward in recovery until I dealt with him. That's what I believed. And I stayed sober a few years and then several years, and some of those things fell away. And I stayed sober another 10 years or so, and most of them fell away. Because this is my program. This is the only program that I need to work. All my answers come from here. All of them. I'm going to tell you a little bit, though, that I have tried to find another program. I did. Because I get a little paranoid every once in a while. So I heard that there was a meeting of Paranoids Anonymous in my area. So, you know, it's hard to get to those meetings because they don't tell you where they meet, you know. So, in fact, they called Intergroup, Paranoids Anonymous Intergroup, and the guy that answered the phone said, "How did you get this number?" I said, man, these people are worse than Al-Anons, you know. So let's see, is there anybody I haven't offended yet today? Let me tell you what happened to me in recovery, because that's where this man changed. So you can't be the same old Fred and do different things, because the same old Fred will do the same old things. And I tried that. I tried it about 3 years in recovery. Tried to just come here and quick study. Just tell me how you do this thing. All I need is the high points. I can go in here, I can BS the rest. You know, I came here, I figured I bought all the books the first night, I'll just go home and study them, take the test, and I'm out of here. You know, piece of cake. How long is it going to take, man? You know, you guys hanging around here 30 years, you ain't getting something. There's something wrong, you know. You got to take a remedial course in this thing, you know. So I figured this is easy. Just give me the books, man, I'll go home, I'll study them up, you know. And that's what I did. That's the way I approached it, but that's not the way it worked. I was at a meeting one night, I was sober 6 months, my sponsor put me up there to speak. And a guy came by and he said to me, you know, he said, that was great. Appreciate you sharing. Just remember that it takes 10 years to get 10 years sobriety. And he walked out the door. And I said, what the hell does that mean? Well, I know now. There's no way to get 10 years except put 10 years in. You know, and I've seen people with 10 years that don't act like they got 10 years. And that's because they're not working the program. See, they're working a program. They're not working this program. That's the problem. Hey, you know, back home we got people that say, well, each of us works our program in our own way. Well, my own way kept getting me drunk. That's why I'm working this program. It's a pretty simple deal. See, now I came back from Texas after that trip to Texas, and I came back to the same building, the same meeting where I kept failing at. Now, the only reason I did that is because I'm that kind of guy, man, just put my head down, and I'm going to do this, you know. And it turned out to be the best thing that I did. And I walked into that meeting that night coming back from Texas feeling real low, and there was this guy down at the end of the hall, and it's probably as far away as that young man is, I think, down there, person down there. I don't have my glasses on. I chose not to do that so I didn't have to really see you, you know. But there's this guy standing out there, and this is Jack. This is Smiling Jack. This is the guy who turned out to be my sponsor. And he's standing down there in the doorway. And I walk in, I got that attitude now, you know. See, I had this spiritual awakening in Texas, but Texas is a long way from New Jersey. So that spirituality just kind of drained out on a plane, you know. And now what I got is this resistance, you know, coming in. And I'm getting ready for Jack, man. And I'm watching him, and I'm thinking, kill him. He says one thing, boom. You know, little guy, you know, with this squeaky voice, you know. I drank about 800 gallons of alcohol and ruined his vocal cords, you know. He's standing down there by the door, and I'm walking down, and I'm looking at him, and I'm figuring I'll get there, man. I'm talking about the last mile, you know. And I got up there to Jack, and for some reason, I said, I'm back, and I'm willing to do anything you tell me. And as the words came out of my mouth, I wanted to grab him and pull him back. I wasn't sure that I wanted to do that. But it came out of my heart, not my mouth. And Jack said, good, go on inside, sit down, and shut up. And I thought, you know, he can't talk to me like this. I got all these degrees, man. This guy's a plumber. What the hell does he know, you know? See, no, I'm big time here. You can't talk to me like this. Oh, Jack talked to me like that. He talked to me like that for a long time. Jack would give me things, and he'd say, here, read this. And I read it. You know, why even read? Why I'd go home to my apartment. At that time, I had an apartment. I never was homeless. See, I never made the street. I lived in a camper in my sister's driveway, about 8 feet from the street. But I never. All right, you know. But now I graduated to an apartment. I didn't have nothing in it, but I had this apartment. I had a sleeping bag and a 7-inch TV, and I borrowed the TV. So I go up to this apartment, and I couldn't let Jack up there because then he'd know I didn't have nothing. So I still had a little pretense going, a little image, you know. So I go up to this apartment, and I had a couple of books, and Jack had given me this thing. It was an issue of the Grapevine, and it was on spiritual awakenings. That whole issue was on spiritual awakenings. And he said, here, read this. And I went home, and I thought, you know, we may as well settle this right now. I mean, I can't let this man go on talking to me like this, and I can't kill him. So what I'm going to have to do is show him what a man with a lot of degrees and supreme intelligence can do with some of this material he's given me to read. So I went in there, and I sat down, and I got dictionary out, and I got Bible out, and I got a yellow legal pad, and I got this little grapevine. And I opened up this grapevine, and you know, the first page of the first article, the first sentence in the first paragraph said, spiritual awakenings. If you are now doing something that you could not do before, you probably have already had one. And I thought, what the hell does that mean? I thought, well, I better look up spiritual. So I looked up spiritual in dictionary. And you know, there are 8 definitions in a Doubleday dictionary of spiritual. One of them was one I didn't expect. And that one definition was of or pertaining to the highest levels of character or morals in a human being. And I thought, wow. So if spiritual awakening could be an awakening of these higher levels of character or morals, and am I bright or what? You know, I figured this out. So now, have I done... Yeah, you know, and when I stopped to think about it, I was not doing some of the things I had done before. You know, I was not sending your wife flowers when you went away on a business trip, you know. I was not selling jobs for two or three times what they were worth just because you had the money and you didn't know about it anyway. You know, I was not running hot cars over to Brooklyn because I needed the money to pay my probation fines. How's that, doing crimes to pay your fines? I wasn't doing those things. So maybe I had already had the spiritual awakening. See, I was on furlough from God, you know. We had separated. I spent 2 years in divinity school. One of those guys came out, wanted to be a priest, and we went to divinity school for 2 years. Took the other seven guys with them. We said, hey, man, this ain't working, you know. They want us to do some things that we cannot do. So we got out of there. But you see, God and I were on a furlough. So I was just kind of, I wasn't bothering him. He didn't bother me, you know. And we just kind of had this little separation agreement. So I started reading this stuff, you know, and I started thinking about this spiritual awakening. And an awakening of those principles, those higher levels of character and morals in this human being, I began feeling better about me. You know, now there were things I couldn't do that I used to do. I just couldn't do them. Whether I needed the money or not, just couldn't do them. You know, it's real simple. And let me tell you how the program works in a big nutshell here. How the program works is, one of the principles I learned is you never say no in AA. You know, that's why I said yes to Louisiana in July. You know, everybody back home said, you're going to Louisiana in July? Now you see, here's how it works, man. It's hotter here than it is here. It's 101 in New York yesterday, so that's so much for those people, see? Well, I came in one night after driving, 180 miles or whatever I did that day, and had a phone call, and somebody saying, well, listen, so-and-so was going on his commitment, and he backed out, and he can't go, and you're going. I said, oh, man. And it gets worse. You know, Jack said, we're going to meet you there. Oh, man. I said, you know, it's about another hour drive from where I was. It's okay. So I get in the car, and I drive there. And I get to this place, Hunterdon Medical Center in New Jersey. It's a great big meeting. And I'm speaking. And Jack's leading, and another one of his pigeons are speaking. That's what we call them home. I don't know if you call them babies or what here. We call them pigeons. And you know why we call them pigeons? You ever seen a pigeon wanders around aimlessly like he's got a lot to do, but he's getting nothing accomplished, you know? That's why we call them pigeons. Every once in a while, his pigeon sponsor comes out and says, go stand over there. You know, they all go over there. So, peanuts are over there, guys. Oh, that's why they call them pigeons. Yeah. But Jack and I had this relationship where I did whatever he told me. But you know, he told me to get in the car and drive there. And when I got there, he said, "You're speaking." And I said, "Okay." So I got up to speak tonight that night. That night, I got up to speaking, and as I'm sitting here, there's a lady sitting there right about that lady sitting there, and she's smiling and shaking her head when I'm telling this story about the grapevine. And as touches me, wow. And I thought, well, she probably read the same article. And after the meeting, she came up and she said, do you know who wrote that article? And I said, no, I don't. She said, my husband did. He's sitting right there. And it turned out that man was dying of cancer. And he's dead now. And I thought, wow, how does this thing work, man? That I ended up on this commitment because this man was going to be in the room that night so he could hear me thank him for introducing me back to God. Wow. Wow. How does this program work? How does it work? Just fine. That's how it works. You know that big guy's up there, man, with that really big guy's up there with those things. I said, get him down there to 100 in, you know. He'll go. Jack's conditioned him. He won't say no. Go ahead. But you don't understand. He'll go, you know. All right? And this poor man had just had his chemotherapy treatment, and he was just weak as hell. And I'm sure his wife got on him like my wife gets on me. You got to go to meetings. I don't care if you had chemotherapy. You got to go to meetings, you know. And he was there at the meeting. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. I got to tell you some of the other things about how I learned how this program works because it's incredible. It caused me to give up. You know, if you're any tough guys out there, give up. All right, give it up. I'm going to tell you a couple of things. I'm going to tell you a couple of things that made me figure out how to just give it up, because that's when it was all going to start to happen. I got to tell you that stopping drinking is only the beginning, man. It may be tough, but it's only the beginning. You know, cutting away pieces of me that I thought were gold, things that I learned in the street, ways of acting, the way men are, just cutting them out of me and doing something different that makes absolutely no sense at all. Just doing it because somebody told you to do it, and then seeing that it works is just—it's just amazing, and that's what changes you. And I got to tell you, I was building a house out in Long Island one time for a guy named D.F. Hutton, and I hope you don't hear that. Now he knows what wrong with his house. We're out there building this house, and I'm driving home from Long Island. Now, you know, when you drive, especially on a Friday night, when you drive west from Long Island to New Jersey, if you make it, you deserve a medal. Okay? That's the kind of drive it is. Now I'm driving home, and I'm thinking, you know, I got to stop. It's hot. The air conditioner was out in my car. I got to stop. And it had this little spaces in here between exits. And I'm thinking, you know, next exit, man, you know, I'm going to just get off, you know. And I went to the next exit, and I did what I did here before. I asked my higher power for help. And two words came to me. Not now. Not now. And I drove to the next exit. And I thought again, not now. And I drove to the next exit. No, no. And I got back to Parsippany, New Jersey, just with that little not now. That little not now. And I got to tell you something. That's the first prayer I said back in this program. It's the first time I really talked to God, you know. See, God don't talk to me. I mean, that's, you know, if I was God, I wouldn't talk to me, you know. But he sends me these little messages. He gives me these little things, you know. And just put those two words in my head that got me back home. There was one more day. There was one more day, because when I got home, there was a message on a machine for the next thing to do. Because he had gotten somebody to put a message on that machine, so it was there when I got there. And he got me home. He got that done, you know. I had a sponsor named Jack. Jack's wife was dying of cancer. The whole first year that Jack drugged me around, took me to meetings. And she eventually died. And Jack had four kids. And every time that Jack would take me out to a meeting, I'd cry on his shoulder and I'd tell him how bad it was, how my life was. And people just didn't really care about me. And my check wasn't there on time. And IRS was after me. Because I hadn't filed in 5 years, and that's probably what they were after me, you know. And I'd tell him just how bad it was. And Jack would say, well, listen, that's okay. Just go upstairs and go to sleep, and I'll pick you up 7:30 tomorrow night, and we'll go to another meeting. And I'd say, okay. And upstairs, and 7:30 the next night, I'd be outside in the next meeting. And after a year in the program, I found out about Jack's wife. Jack never said a word to me about what was going on in his life. He just did the right thing for this drunk. That's all, you know. Never said a word. So he taught me something. You just do what you're supposed to do and you keep your mouth shut. That's the way the program works. I had a guy named Jack that was an old man, Jack, in our area. A pair of Jacks played a big part in my life. Old Jack was a guy that coupled up with my sponsor, Jack. And these two guys, you know, my sponsor Jack would say to me every time I call him up, what step you on? You know, I'd just say, Jack, how you doing? Hey, Fred, what step you on? Four. What? Four. You've been on this damn step for about 2 years now, man. You want to die? No, no. You want to get drunk? No, you better do the step. So finally, you know, tried to do the step, and I'm working on it, and I'm working on this thing. Being excessive, you know, having to be perfection, man. You know, just tell me they would do it, you know. I was buying all these step books. I was buying, you know, 23 lists of things that alcoholics do. Oh, buy it, man. And I got a book, a five-section notebook, you know, putting a jealousy on the top of one page, left about 8 pages for that. You know, intolerance on another. Oh, writing every night home, writing. I'm going to do the steps, going to Akron, AA Hall of Fame when I'm done, you know. People are going to be calling up from all around the world, say, send me a copy of Fred Stepp, you know. The end result of which was that after 16 months, I hadn't got it done. And Jack was after me, you're going to do it, you're going to do it, you're going to do it. Finally, one night I walked in a Parsippany meeting, and this guy says to me, you done with your step yet? And I said, no. And he said, you've been working on it a long time, you know. that attitude comes back. Is he bright or what? You know, man, I'm coming in here for 18, 16 months. He said, well, listen, it's got to be a lot simpler than what you're trying to do. So what do you mean? He said, just go home and get a piece of paper and you write down on one side the things you like about yourself because that's what you need more of. And you write down on the other side of the paper the things you don't like about yourself because that's what you got to get rid of. And I said, okay. I went home, I sat down. By the time Johnny Carson was over, did the 4-step. Now, I don't want to rush into sobriety or nothing. So I took that 4-step, folded it up, put it in my sun visor, drove around with it for 18 months. So I'm thinking to myself, you know, I ain't going to tell this fool all these things I did about myself, you know? I ain't going to tell him these things because I don't want nobody coming to these meetings knowing everything I did. I'm going to sit in meetings and he's going to be looking at me, shaking his head, and I'll know what he's thinking. So I ain't telling him. But I got to do this, see? Because part of this thing, you know, the way my mind worked, part of this thing was that what you got to do is you got to like get over on your sponsor. You got to make like you're doing this thing. You don't really have to do it. You just got to look like you're doing it. So I figured this out. I'm driving home one night again from Long Island. Yeah, it turns out all my spiritual awakenings are coming from Long Island. I'm driving home from Long Island one night working on this house, and I thought to myself, I got it. I got it. I know this guy out in Pennsylvania, old Jack, see? Jack, 72. 72 years old. I figured, well, 72, I can go out there and give him my 5-step. He lives in Pennsylvania. 72, he's going to die soon. What the hell? Good deal. Figured it out, see? Went home, and it was such a good plan. I went home, picked up the phone, and I called Jack, and I figured, well, you know, he's old. He's probably going to bed already anyway, so I'll call him up and make like I'm doing this. And then when I go to my meeting and talk to my sponsor, I can say, well, I tried to call him, but, you know, he was in bed, you know. So I went home. It was about 6:30. I got home, and I called Jack up, and I said, I picked you. Like, this is a real honor, you know. I picked you to do my 5-step with. And he said, good. Why don't you come out tonight? And I said, next thing I know, I'm in a car driving to Pennsylvania. And I'm sitting down with old Jack, who is a retired New York City cop, always munching on a cigar. And he was volunteering, 72 years old. He was volunteering in a detox on a midnight shift. We went in there, we sat down, and I gave him my 5-step. And when I was done, he said, well, you done? I said, yeah. Well, he says, I'm not very impressed. This is all the worst stuff I ever did in my life, man. I wish they'd add a few things on the way out there, you know? Well, let me tell you how this program works and why I had to stop trying to figure it out. This is a great plan. Jack's going to die. He's going to have my 5-step. He'll go out with my 5-step. Great. Well, he's still alive. He's 88 years old now. Just celebrated 47 years of sobriety. Wait a minute. And about 5 years ago, he moved back to New Jersey. Now he's at every meeting that I go to. There he is, sitting here, knows all my stuff. Every time I see him looking at me, shaking his head, I know what he's thinking about. And that's what I learned. Just do it, man. Just do it. If it's in a book and they laid it out like that, just do it. You know, just do it. Now let me tell you how it works and how it's supposed to work according to the way I think. So I had this big old ugly guy named George, you know, and I sponsored George. And George is a tough guy. He's a longshoreman. You know, he talks like that, you know. He's a tough guy. And I get all the big guys, the tough guys, that are crazy guys. I wonder why that is. But old George came to me and he said, we got to do a 5-step. Because I've been pushing him to do his 4-step. And we sat down out at my patio one night and we did his 5-step. And he told me about all these horrible things he did when he was in the service and in the Philippines and all these just terrible, terrible things that he did. And we sat out there in my backyard. And we cried, I cried, he cried. And when he was done, I said, are you done? He said, yeah. I said, well, I'm not very impressed. And I took the weight off of George's shoulders, just like old Jack took it off of my shoulders. Because we all think we're so bad, you know. We all think the things that we did are just so bad. And then some one of us comes along and says, let me help you with that. And that's what I did for George, you know. We had Tom here last night from San Diego, and I'll tell you how this program works. I got to go to Hawaii a couple of years ago and hear a guy from San Diego. The guy's name was Keith. And Keith, I believe my higher power got Keith there and he got me there so Keith could give me a message. Thank God that's the only way my higher power figured out of getting us two together to get the message, because it was real nice to hear it in Hawaii. Went to this thing called the Big Island Bash, and Keith was speaking, and I was sitting there, and I'm listening to Keith, and I'm really identifying, and Keith is talking about some of the kids that he sponsored got together and bought him this present. They bought him a present, and they gave it to him because he didn't know why, but he went to his sponsor, and he said, "Why did they do this? Why did they do this?" And the sponsor said to him, "Maybe you've become something that they want to be." I said, "Wow. Wow." And I heard that. I heard that in April of 1990. And on Father's Day of 1990, June 1990, this big ugly guy named George, who lost his license for 12 years, he came to my house. And he lives quite a distance from where I live. And I had to take a train and a cab and a couple of trains, actually, to get there. And I showed up home, and he was sitting on my porch. And he had a box with seven cigars in it, best cigars that I smoke, and only seven because that's all I could afford to buy. And he gave them to me. He gave them to me, and he said that I had been more of a father to him than his father had been. And I thought about Keith, and I thought how this message goes around. If I hadn't been in Hawaii to hear Keith, I wouldn't understand why George had to do this. You know, and I thought to myself, my God, could I have become something that he wants to be? See, I stole the people's money. I stole their money. And here this kid is looking up to me. Now, what a responsibility that is. What a responsibility that is to just do it the way it's in the book, not the way I interpret it. Just do it the way they did it, because that's the kind of feelings they got. And it's been passed on to me, and I got to pass it on to him. Not run through me. But the way I learned it, just give it back to him. In my sobriety, I've had a lot of opportunity to go back and do things over that I did wrong. I've had a lot of opportunity, and more than maybe some of us have had, and I feel fortunate that way. I'm getting real tired of going back and doing things over, but I'm fortunate to have done that, you know. I had the opportunity. I was a builder, and I was a cheat. I was a thief as a builder, and I had the opportunity to go back and be a builder in sobriety and do it right. And I build good houses. I was known as an honest builder. I was a bad husband. I did terrible things to the woman I was married to. So bad that it's almost 20 years later, and she still hates me. That's what I did to her. But I've had the opportunity with this wife now, Pat, to be a good husband, and I am. I am a good husband. I've had the opportunity to be a good father, as I was a bad father. I was a horrible father. The first 3 or 4 years my son was alive, I couldn't have picked him out in a crowd because I was never around. But I've had the opportunity to go back and be a good father. We put him through college. You know, we did it right. He got every opportunity that I never got. And I love him, and he loves me. And every time I talk to him on the phone now or see him, I tell him I love him. Nobody ever told me they loved me. There was nobody there. One thing I never had a chance to go back for, that was to be a good son, because I was a bad son. I was a drunk. My father was a drunk. And I can only think about how I must have made my mother feel. I must have made her feel terrible, because he died in a bar fight, and I was always in bar fights. And I never got that chance to be a good son. Because I was drinking when she died. And the night I got the phone call, my sister called me and she said, "You better come here, Mommy's dying." And I got up and I had 3 or 4 beers just so I could drive that car. And by the time I had those 2 more beers, the phone call came back and said she was dead. So I never got to go back and do that. This is my first time speaking at a convention, so I want to say it here and right now. Mom, I never got there that night, and I'm sorry I wasn't there. But I'm here now.